Testing, testing, testing. This is tape number 3 of the story, The Boss in the Wall, a treatise on the house devil by Avram Davidson and Grania Davis, read by Goblin Hood. One good look showed him the cabinet, whose lock had been jimmied open, and the tiny note saying, "April Fool." Was there anything he could do which would be of the least help and comfort to him? Selby Silas knew well that there was nothing he could do. As for the musty, Larrabee grilled him until he was scorched on both sides. He told Larrabee that he could handle the red men, and he could handle the black men and paper men, but he could not handle the New York police men. This was perhaps the truth, although certainly not the whole truth, but then the musty wasn't under oath.
"You owe me a head," said Larrabee.
What else could he have said? Edward Bagnell unfolded his morning paper and was jolted fully awake. There was the paper man's head. The devil's head. Ephraim Macklewitz's head. Gazing at him slyly, Bagnell realized that the dreadful secret, so long concealed, had begun to escape from its dreadfully long concealment. Professor Vlad Smith was not reading the newspapers. Jack Stewart had said they were close to his home, and he wanted to spend a few days with his family, who hadn't seen him since winter vacation. So Vlad dropped him off and continued alone. Later, he phoned his own family, and to his pleasure and surprise, Elsa answered the phone. "Bella is a little better, thank God. She's seeing a psychiatrist who has her on a low dose of medication. But I wish she wasn't so listless," Elsa said. This last word, with its tone of emotion, however unhappy, gave Vlad hope that Elsa was starting to feel again, and that eventually her feelings might again include him. Vlad recalled that one of the names Weberschaw had mentioned as part of the secret committee was Zimmerman, and he guessed that this was Claire Zimmerman, a woman he had often enjoyed meeting at folklore conferences. She lived nearby, and perhaps she could help him.
"Hello, Claire?"
"Why, Vlad Smith." A bear hug.
"Excuse the abrupt appearance at this hour. I tried 3 times to phone you, but the line..."
"I just made fresh coffee and have a slice of cake."
She handed him coffee and cake, and their hands brushed. Vlad had never before noticed how soft her hands were, or how her sleek dark hair framed her round and downy cheeks. Better to stop noticing.
"I'm researching that old legend, the paper man, or boss in the wall."
"Oh, I suppose you saw the picture in the paper. Ghastly thing."
She handed him a folded newspaper, and this time he didn't even notice that their hands brushed. Vlad stared with startled blue-gray eyes at the newspaper photo of the devil's head, while Claire rattled on with just a slight nervous edge in her voice.
"You had seen it, hadn't you? I mean, I assumed that's what you came to talk about because of my research project with old news clippings and all. Well, that photo is startling, but nothing new, really, nothing new at all. Here, let me show you some examples."
She pulled a file of photocopies off a shelf.
"Look at this one from the New Orleans Daily Picayune, dated March 12, 1871, right next to an ad for Ayers Medicinal Sarsaparilla, and another ad for a hot spring cure for opium habits. The headline is, kneeling down to idols. It says, in a dark row of tenements on Demain Street is a very old building with crumbling walls overgrown with wild creepers. Rain drops through the roof without restraint. A low, heavy doorway admits the visitor to a gloomy cell with a hard earthen floor. In one corner of the room is a bundle of rags, and on the wretched pallet reposes a half-naked Voodoo doctor beneath the idol of some heathenish divinity. It goes on like that for quite a while, but you see, this sort of thing is not new, Vlad. Not at all. Vlad impulsively cupped her round and warm cheeks in his two long hands.
The legends aren't new, Claire. What's new is that the legends are real, and you know it, and the committee knows it, and I need to know what's going on.
Vlad told her all that had happened, and when he finished, she sipped her coffee silently for a moment, then said in a soft voice,
I didn't know, Vlad. I'm so sorry this happened to your family, and to you, because I've always liked you. You're great at puncturing stuffed shirts at conferences. Oh, hell, take this memo. It has the date and location of the next committee meeting. And tell them Claire sent you.
Vlad thanked her, then he thanked her again. Then he said it was getting late and started towards the door. Then he turned and thanked her again and took her hands. Her hand. Then their lips brushed. And her open mouth was soft and warm. Later that night, Vlad read from the interim committee report. It is said that the Gullahs of the Georgia coast sometimes refer to them as thunder people because of the belief that they are seen more often during thunderstorms. Dr. Albright suggests that they may seize upon these deafening noises to cover their own well-known and well-feared sounds. Or perhaps the boss in the wall is discomfited by the falling of the barometer and is impelled to move and to stir about. In certain border states, the obscure term hi-et is found, which may be related to a little-known tale. There was a banker named Williams who had a wife named Dorcas and a daughter named Mary Martha. The family was prosperous, and Dorcas always liked to see a good plate of victuals on the table, and had a closet full of good black silk dresses. After Williams died of consumption, it was discovered that most of the bank's assets had been invested in beautifully engraved but worthless bonds. In all the excitement and tumult which followed, nobody gave much thought to the widow Williams and her daughter. During the next few months, six babies were reported missing from sharecroppers' shacks in the vicinity. Perhaps the number was more, for the poor sometimes counted their blessings in the way of children and concluded that they had been overblessed. The word gypsies was mentioned, and many a mother threw up her hands in horror. Constable Stebbins was sent to investigate, a rough but kindly man. It occurred to him that Mrs. and Miss Williams had not been seen lately, and he went to inquire if they had been bothered by any frightening strangers. He went to the back of the house, and its neglected condition made him feel uneasy. But Miss Mary Williams assured him that she and her mother were quite all right, and that they had seen no suspicious characters or small children around. Her complexion was very pale, and there was a slight smile on her lips. Then the constable noted something red beneath the edge of a large towel in the kitchen, and he recalled that one of the missing children had been wearing a red dress. He lifted the towel and found a basket full of baby's clothes. Then Miss Mary Williams looked at him with her small little smile and said, Mother was very hungry.
No such shocking event had ever occurred in the county as the news that Mary Williams had drowned at least 6 small children and carried them home in her shawl to be eaten. The people screamed for her blood. How much did old Mrs. Williams know? All she said was, "Nobody cared about me and my baby." Mary Williams was sentenced to be hanged, and her mother was sent to a lunatic asylum for life. Miss Williams' last words were, "Will they feed mother good there?" Mrs. Dorcas Williams was allowed to bring her best black silk dress to the asylum, and they say that she sat in a certain chair in the ward without speaking a word for 37 years. They say that she ate hearty and never spotted her black silk dress. Mrs. Williams' family name was Hyatt, and any small children in the region will run screaming if one says, "Mother Hyatt was very hungry." Vlad picked up Jack from his family's house and said that they were off to a meeting of the mysterious committee. The man at the head of the table said that, like the interesting club in New York City whose only rule was that there were no rules, this committee had no name, no schedule of meetings. This was either its 3rd, 10th, or 12th session, depending on how you looked at it, and no formal chair. "And if anyone else would rather chair this, speak up. I'll gracefully yield." No one spoke up. Then the people around the table looked up to see 2 other people who hadn't been present before. "What the hell?" said Bagnell. "You're not supposed to be here, you know."
"I know," said Vlad Smith. "Do you still doubt what I saw?" said Bagnell.
"I never doubted it."
"Why the secrecy, Branch? Why?" asked Vlad.
"I was trying to protect you," said Dave Branch.
"Like hell," said Jack Stewart. You were all trying to protect your frigging academic turf." The men faced each other silently for a moment.
"Who told you?" asked Bagnell.
"I told them," said Claire Zimmerman. "They are here at my invitation because they belong here. So let's stop squabbling over which kids are allowed in the clubhouse and get on with it."
Having no other choice, they got on with it. The man at the head of the table, whom Branch identified for Vlad and Jack as Augustus Elbaum, had a reddish grizzled beard. He sighed and said, "All right, on the principle that it doesn't matter where you begin to measure the circumference of a circle, as usual, we'll begin anywhere. Notes and queries have been sent to me, and I've answered some and sent some around. We'll go over a few of them anyway." He paused and looked around the table, then continued. "The trouble is, you know, we are getting in over our depths. We began as a group of folklorists, most of us trained to classify and catalog. Oh, this is obviously a version of Childe Ballad, number such and such. Now we've got historians, criminologists, physicians, and we just keep getting in deeper and deeper. We may already be in over our heads. Seen the newspapers, seen a certain picture of a certain head." A stir in the chamber. Not a particularly stately chamber. One might expect to see it contain a meeting of insurance salesmen looking at graphs. A stir, and a woman said, "This is definitely one of ours?" Bagnell said almost wearily, "It is definitely one of ours. By and by we'll show you another photograph. You'll need no convincing. But how it got to be part of a Caribbean cult ceremony in New York, I have no idea. Perhaps just as well, because if I had an idea, so would the press. He eased his long, lanky body back into his chair. Elbaum began to pick up papers and read aloud. Could the jerky gait ascribed to the string fellow be explained by the shortening of tendons? If so, which tendons and how do they shrink? Would you give that one some thought, Dr. Calloway?
Okay, Gus.
Yes, get back to you on it. In the silence right after the incessant sound of the air conditioning, made itself heard. Before Elbaum could read another slip of paper, there was a vocal query in the bland, blank room. What became of the mental patient, Hill Smith, who... Bagnell stirred and spoke. Yes, I investigated that myself. Oh, Hill Smith is certainly insane, with a horrible and disturbing delusion. On one level, it's a mad reiteration of parts of the Bible, particularly the vision of Ezekiel in the Valley of the Dried Bones. No doubt about that. But on another level, perhaps it was triggered by the actual sighting of dormant paper men, a whole group of them, maybe, in a very old house, suddenly coming alive, so to speak, and beginning to move, enough to knock anybody off the steady spin around his metal axis. Claire said softly and thoughtfully, her black hair hugging her round face, Dr. Elbaum, I've been wondering why, so far, there only seem to be paper men. Why hasn't there been a single report of a paper woman? This is hardly an equal opportunity issue, but still I wonder, don't you? Elbaum poured a glass of water and after a moment said, We just don't know. That's a measure of our ignorance, not our knowledge. Why do women get pregnant and men have prostate trouble? We all know why, but with this other, we can't and don't see why. One of many things for which we have no answer, but that's not to say we don't have a question. Why do sightings of paper men occur most frequently just before outbreaks of war? Does the hostility and tension in the air stir them? Do our current tensions explain the upsurge of recent sightings? We have far more questions than we have answers. A pale woman in an odd sort of hat scratched some notes on a pad and spoke. If the disease model is correct, all the life processes would be slowed down. Metabolism, pulse, peristalsis, mental functioning, extreme desiccation. Could the paper man possibly speak when he's jolted from his dormant state, or when he's still in the transition from life to pseudo-life? Could he talk to us?
Impossible, said someone. There were murmurs of discussion in the meeting room. Someone else said, There would be no pulse as we know it, I should think. The hedgehog in hibernation may be said to cease breathing. Hibernating hedgehogs have been submerged in water for over half an hour, and they didn't drown, they just got wet. Silence, the air a dull, cool, which did not refresh.
I'd say, from what I've heard and read and thought about, it seems to me that some of them died despairing and some died hating. And those ones that are most dangerous died hating. Someone who had been drinking water suddenly put it down and asked hastily, Oh, say, Gus, rats? About those rats? About the rats? Elbaum wondered aloud, Where to begin, where to begin? Then said that he would begin by considering not merely no supernatural explanation, but no explanation that could not be made in only moderately non-conventional terms. Okay, about them eating rats, let's say we have someone named Jack Jones in, say, Memphis in 1845, suffering from any one of a number of possible diseases causing intense cramps and vomiting. Say there's been an outbreak of cholera or plague. Everyone will at once assume he's got the pest, and everyone will clear out fast. So now assume that he is a stranger in Memphis and he's all alone in some shack, some whore's crib. Okay, time passes, no one comes near him. He might very well have died, but somehow he doesn't die. After a week or two, he's probably on the floor and he may be partially naked. Hell, even entirely naked. Need I say that he's terribly emaciated, puking and nearly dead, glary-eyed and gone, and very likely more than a bit out of his mind. He's famished, famished. If there'd been a crust of bread, a cheese rind, or a bacon rind, why, he'd already eaten that long ago, as soon as he could eat. Then along comes a rat. A rat creeps along the wall, as rats do. Elbaum sipped from a coffee cup, gazed around the meeting room, and continued, "Now, I have never tried to catch a rat with my bare hands, and I grant you that it's hard for even a healthy man to catch a rat, and Jack Jones is not in good health at all. But I give you this thought, perhaps the rat is not in good health either. Rats get sick and rats die, sometimes where people can see them. If a plague was on, more rats would be dying openly. Perhaps the rat is nearly dead from plague, or maybe it's got something related to Paper Man's disease. Jack Jones eats the rat or laps its blood, and his immune system, already weakened, of course picks up whatever sickness the rat has. Now let's say that by and by someone else is sneaking around, looking for something to steal in a presumably empty shack. Now, who is this potential thief? It could be some low-down, uneducated, ignorant, ignoble, dim-witted, down-and-out fellow named Anstrobel. He comes sneaking up to this shack. He peeps inside. He sees a sort of living skeleton with glary eyes biting into a rat. What do you think Anstrobel does? Do you think that he tarries, that Anstrobel comes forward and says, "Worthy and suffering Christian brother, allow me to give you succor and sustenance"? Hell no. Anstrobel never gave anybody anything, except maybe the clap. He runs off and his poor maggoty mind is going to report, "I seed a date man eating a rat." Even though it's now believed that the boss in the wall never actually eats the rat, merely he laps its blood, easier than chewing with wasted jaw muscles and easier to digest as well. Multiply this one instance by hundreds and our rat-eating legend takes off. Hamling Calloway, M.D., looked down along the table, provided with, at intervals, the pads of paper, the short, sharp pencils, the glasses of water. The table might have been set for a meeting about changing zoning laws or a discussion of splitting a stock. "Gus, the picture you have just drawn, why, it's very vivid. No reason why it couldn't be perfectly correct. So let us not linger. I'd like to move along to why, certainly not to a supernatural explanation, but to one which is certainly impossible to explain in fairly or even unfairly conventional terms." Elbaum absently stroked his short and grizzled beard with its still visible streaks of red. What do I mean? Well, what happened to Jack Jones? What became of him back then in Memphis in 1845, after he'd recovered enough to eat his rat, or rather, Lappet's blood? What happened to him? Elbaum suggested that any number of things might have happened. He might have recovered after his nip of rat blood and gotten dressed and on his feet and returned to the cotton farm or the riverboat. Maybe. But maybe Jack Jones never quite died, but never quite recovered from his rat-borne disease. Maybe he became an outcast and a skulker and a lurker. Imagine that, if you can, growing older and filthier and more emaciated, creeping from one abandoned house to another, living off scraps and rats, never able to be anything but emaciated, sometimes hiding in the walls, a boss in the wall, but a boss nowhere else, and maybe in cold weather, in colder weather, wrapping his wasted body in layer after layer of old newspapers to keep out the cold as all his physiological functions declined. Elbaum again stroked his reddish-gray beard. Imagine this in hundreds of cities and towns, not just in the 1800s, but now. We know that most derelicts we see in doorways are suffering from the diseases of alcoholism or schizophrenia or from a diseased society. But some may be slowly wasting away from Paperman's disease. That could explain why there are always more bosses forming, even though so many get killed off. And that could explain why the boss in the wall legend appears everywhere and never dies out. A woman in the far corner now lifted her head and cleared her throat with an odd sort of sound. Vlad had not really registered her presence, and judging by a sudden shuffling and half-turning on the part of others, there were a number of them who had now suddenly remembered that they had forgotten. Jack Stewart said later that she had instantly reminded him of Aunt Pearline, the one you never see except at a funeral, and you see her at every funeral, including the ones you try to keep quiet. Vlad, in a whisper,
"Ed, who is she?"
Bagnell, writing his reply on a pad. Dr. Isabella Croakshank, rats. She was by no means a young woman. She cleared her throat again with that odd sort of squeak and touched her lips with a tissue. They were probably by now, by nature, pale lips. But Dr. Isabel Croakshank had been a young woman when young women were first able to combine makeup and respectability. And, however odd it seemed, her withered lips were still, in the manner of her youth, rouged red with lipstick, bright against that pallid face, bright red. At last she spoke.
"What Dr. Elbaum says is logical, very logical. Now, I was first drawn into this somewhat clandestine project here, purely because I might learn something which might lead to some explanation of the irregularly regular appearances of exsanguinated rats. I was skeptical, perhaps more than I need have been. There are some weird and wonderful things about rats. Don't let me go on for too long. It's more than a discipline. It's an obsession. But have you ever heard of a rat king? I see few of you have." I refer you to my work called Tail-Tied Kings,
Well, it's not a king of the rats. Not an individual rat, but a group of rats. This king. Oh, from time to time, there have been found in Europe, in America, a number of rats of both sexes, which are bound together by, literally, their tails being tied together. No string or cord, just the tails themselves. I long ago ruled out hoaxes. For one thing, they have been found in places ordinarily inaccessible to humans, found when buildings are being demolished, for example. Now, what has caused this phenomenon? Dr. Isabel Cruikshank paused and drank water. No one moved. Well now, how, for example, did they live, obtain food, water? Evidently, this was brought by mouth by other rats. The only theory ever really seriously considered was that other rats had selected them as a sort of gene pool, breeding pool, while they were very young, and by tooth and claw and paw had made those knots. The matter certainly remains not proven. During the course of this conference, a notion came to me. It is only a notion. Is it possible, I have asked myself, that this, the boss in the wall, the paper man, is that what made them? Could those, dare I borrow from another legend, a term, the undead, could they have tied the rats' tails together, taken young rats, and done that, leaving up to the rat groups the perhaps instinctively performed job of bringing food, perhaps food dipped in water, so that when and if the boss in the wall wanted a rat, it had only to go and get one. Perhaps the silence shuddered. No one offered an answer. No one said a word or made another sound for a while. Dr. Elbaum looked at his watch. Then he said, "It's 2 o'clock. I believe that Dr. Dave Branch and Dr. Ed Bagnell, boys." They nodded, got up. Bagnell set up a screen while Branch got the projector ready. Branch's narrow face was usually grave. Now it was somber. "All right," he said, nodding. Bagnell turned out the lights. Branch said, "We are about to show a photograph of perhaps the only intact boss in the wall. Oh, I don't know why I prefer that name. Or paper man. Not a head alone. It's even less of a pretty sight. So all those suspecting they may be faint of heart may leave." Nobody left. "All right, here we go. At the count of 3, 1, 2, 3. The image on the screen was very blurred and only gradually became clear. Very clear. The photograph was actually 2 photographs side by side on 1 slide. 4. The mouth seemed fallen open. One eye looked right at them. One eye was rolled up. One clawed hand was at chest level. The other seemed to gesture from alongside the ear. Only shreds of clothing were left. And in some places, only shreds of paper, with here and there only a patch of it adhering to a skin which clung to the bones like crepe paper. Aft, there was more paper on the backside and along the backbone. This seemed deeply depressed on either side. The skin on the lower extremities seemed more tightly fitted, though the left leg and buttock
appeared much torn. It was not evident how.
Well, had enough? Too bad. The screen went blank.
Branch moved to another projector. All those who now know that they are faint of heart may now leave. What we are now about to show purports to be the only moving picture of a boss in the wall. Evidently somebody wanted to. There was a scuffle of a chair being pushed back. The dimness was relieved for an odd moment as a door opened, shut. Here we go, at the count of three. The film was badly made. It was jerky and dim, and it flickered. It was also totally and horribly convincing, in a voice which, low as it was, carried. Branch said, "I'm not allowed to tell you where, when, how it was shot." The lights came on again. Elbaum spoke up after a moment. "My question now is there anybody here, anyone amongst us, who still doubts the actual and physical, factual, tangible existence of the creature known as the paper man or the boss in the wall?" A massive black man with an immense face opened his massive mouth and spoke in an immense bass organ note.
"Let the record state that Bishop Burton Blankenship has no doubt, and never had. I now yield."
Don't know how anybody could any longer after that movie. Hughes of the criminology lab, dapper, calm, seeming not in the least worried or upset. Hughes said, "Ah, yes, that movie, impressive. How do we know it's the real thing?"
"Well," Hughes lightly stroked his mustache, slightly smiled, and said,
"I trust that no one trained in a scientific discipline is going to say to anyone else trained in a scientific discipline, 'You'll just have to take my word for it.' You, Dr. Dave Branch, have declared that there are things about the film which you can't or won't tell us. How can you really expect us to bring in any other verdict except the Scottish one, not proven?"
"Well, how can you be certain that you yourself have not been hoaxed?
You can't, I think. After all, what are generally called special effects have been around a pretty long time. Isn't that so? Not all hoaxes are done for money or notoriety or this or that. I believe, and it's an educated belief, that most hoaxes are done because the hoaxer liked that particular hoax. People whom I trust, as I trust you, have been known to be taken in by doctored evidence. So I say, I have to withhold my judgment. I don't know."
The pause after he concluded was punctured by a small sub-vocal sound from a middle-aged man in, despite the summer's heat, a dark suit and white shirt. He now looked up and, with slightly raised eyebrows, looked around, not as if he were waiting for others, but as though the others were waiting for him. The technique worked, and Dr. Darnell Frost began to speak. There was something in his manner which reminded Vlad of certain members of the clergy, of those few denominations which do not have a paid ministry, and thus have to earn their income by worldly means. When they served in the marketplace, there was nevertheless a touch of the pulpit in their manner, and when they served in the pulpit, a touch of the marketplace. He spoke in a manner both rapid and clear. His sparse hair was reddish gold, and he wore
gold-rimmed eyeglasses. Perhaps we have been too much carried away by the unpleasant aspects of our subject. Is this possible? Our subject is not really a damned soul, after all. He's a most unfortunate human being. But nevertheless, a human being. He is the victim, it seems likely, of a very dread disease, like old Tithonus. He has been cursed with eternal life without eternal youth. We don't know how many he may be, but he is not a demon cast out of a herd of swine. He is simply an unfortunate human being to whom something extraordinary has happened. He is our fellow countryman, and in at least one instance, he has fought in our country's wars, wearing the indigo uniform. We all know there was an old farmhouse right in the middle of the Battle of Bull Run, and an old woman died there during the battle. How can we know who else crawled into that house to die, or to not die? How can we not have compassion for him as our brother? Vlad saw Bagnell and Branch match eyes. Whatever Darnell Frost was up to, it was something a vast deal different from what the others had been up to. Frost went on in his rapid way, one word almost overtaking the other. Is his disease, let's call it Paperman's disease, is it worse than leprosy? At one time, the unfortunate victims of leprosy were isolated from society forever. We winced when we saw their dreadful deformities and heard their warning bells. If they did not submit, they were hunted down. But that is mercifully a thing of the past, and oh, what a good thing that it is. They aren't even called lepers now. They are victims of Hansen's bacillus. We don't cast them out, Frost declared, shaking his head. We beckon them in and treat them. Yes, we do. Am I not also a man and a brother? Is not the victim of Paperman's disease a man and a brother like the victim of Hansen's disease? Why, yes, he is. I appeal to us all to rise to the incredible challenge which this study presents. I am speaking not only of compassion, but of profit. You ask, what? Profit? You wonder how I can be so bold, but I say that we must not feel afraid, but hopeful. For this wretched and unfortunate creature has, I truly believe, a precious secret locked within his body, the most precious secret any creature may have, the secret that every living being desires, my friends and colleagues. What secret is that? Why, it is so obvious. Why haven't I heard it from anyone gathered here? The precious secret which, like the ugly and venomous toad, the paper man bears in his body. Why, of course, that secret is life. By now, all eyes were on Dr. Darnell Frost. That secret, my friends, my colleagues, is life. Oh, I don't dare say eternal life. No, I don't. But is a lifespan prolonged for, let's say, a century and a half, is such a lifespan nothing? Vlad rose to his feet as the bile rose in his mouth.
My God, man, such a life is worse than nothing, he shouted.
Frost waved him gently down. Be patient with me, dear sir, and then it will be your turn. I've been patient with all of you. The paper man's life has been sad and terrible, true, but I say it need not be. I say, why weepest thou? Arise now, and gird up thy loins. We are men and women, people of science. We do not take the past for granted. We must not tarry. We have tasks of the topmost priority, friends and colleagues. We must track the paper man in every hidden wall and closet and doorway, in every wretched building and slum that he inhabits. We must take hold of him gently and lead him to refuge where he may be studied with every merciful consideration, like every other victim of a baffling disease. After full-scale research, which will surely discover his secret, we will share this secret with our fellow men and women. My dearest friends, we have no choice. It's not a thing which permits of hesitation, and we must share it with all humankind. and we will share the glory and the profit among ourselves. There! He slapped his neat stack of notes on the table and looked around the room. Dr. Darnell Frost had staked his claim. The room was in commotion. Calloway was on his feet, shouting. Branch was pounding his fist on the table, shouting, "What are you going to do, milk them like snakes?" Brad's startled blue-gray eyes met Jack's. Both men looked shocked, troubled.
"I think we've found the kernel in the nut," said Brad. "He can't be serious."
"Frost sees himself in the newspapers," said Jack Stewart, "on the cover of Time, or even more in the Reader's Digest, which is what he probably reads. He doesn't know what kinds of worms are in that can, and he doesn't want to know either." Branch leaned over to Vlad. Grimly, he said, "Well, now you know why I didn't want to tell you before, why I wanted to protect you. Have you seen enough? Are you happy now?" Vlad said,
"I wasn't happy before, but I've seen enough for now."
"Details must be worked out as we go along. Doctors, professors, admittedly, there's an immense amount of work, but..." Frost had staked his claim. Who knew where the assay office was? It could hardly be said yet that the rush was on, but certainly the brawling had already started in the mining camp. 6. The old, old house revealed. Why had Hillsmith not received his usual dose of Thorazine? No one really knew. Doors would slam and heads would roll. Thorough investigations be made. The facts would never be discovered. Things sometimes happened which should not. Confusion followed, for in fact, the hospital was always overcrowded and understaffed. Even the locked ward could not always be kept locked. Could every linen locker? Hillsmith, for once alert and cunning, had turned into a quick change artist. Finding the ward briefly unlocked, he slipped into the staff physician's shower room and emerged with the clothing and ID badge of someone in the shower. Properly clad and badged, he calmly strolled along, looking here and there, and, sure enough, "There's my bag," he said aloud, but not loudly. The car keys were in the bag, and the gate guard, due for retirement, had other things on his mind. Never mind the gate guard, Hillsmith didn't. He got as far as Bodley Hill when the car ran out of gas. Hillsmith continued on foot. He persuaded young Eddie Fritz at the gas station to keep the doctor bag as security for a can of gas. It was always a question around Bodley Hill. Was that Nasser Fauntleroy boy crazy or just plain mean? Nasser greeted Hillsmith at first sight with a loud cry of, "Hey, Dr. Flim Flam, what you wearing them funny clothes for, Dr. Floy Floy? I says, hey, hey!" This getting no response, and perhaps desiring none, he fell into step a safe distance behind and began following his latest victim in an exaggerated version of the victim's gait, all the while jeering and hooting and mocking. In fact, it was almost impossible to get rid of him. If ignored, he kept on. If confronted, he increased his attack. If smiled at, he became more brutal. He had been known to follow someone for miles. Hillsmith kept on, carrying the can of gas. So did Nasser Fauntleroy, flinging out fists and feet, breaking out when he saw fit. Hillsmith turned up River Road and up a lane containing a certain old house. He began to gather wooden rubble from the littered lane. At this point, a curious change came over Nasser Fauntleroy. His stiff-legged steps faltered, and he looked all around. He slowed. He made many faces. He never entirely stopped, but he did, however, fall quite quiet. Vlad had seen enough, and now he wanted only to see his family. His favorite niece, Elizabeth, answered the phone.
"How's your Aunt Elsa?"
asked Vlad.
"She's playing golf. They're all playing golf," said Elizabeth.
"Say, that's great,"
Vlad exclaimed.
"And Bella?"
"She's taking her nap on the screened porch."
"Cooler, eh?"
"Well, she won't sleep inside."
Vlad winced.
"Is she having any of her attacks?"
"Nope,"
said Elizabeth.
"Does she smile and laugh?"
"Nope."
"Does she eat or talk?"
"Little bit."
"Listen, I'm coming to pick her up, to take her for a drive, okay?"
There commenced a pause and a series of squalid sounds, which Vlad analyzed as those of a teenager eating an apple. Then,
"Yeah, I guess so. Okay."
Vlad dropped off Jack Stewart to attend to some business of his own and went to pick up Bella. After he drove for a while with the quiet and withdrawn child beside him in the car, he had the great and good idea of returning to the old house. Bella would see the place in the sunlight as she had first seen it, when the creature would be quiescent, and she would realize there was nothing to fear. It seemed worth a try. All the psychologists and medications clearly weren't helping. Bella did not recognize the old house, so Vlad took her inside to the room where the tragedy had occurred. Hillsmith paused in the lane in front of the old house and eyed a car parked near the overgrown drive. Then he continued his stride. There was a lot of debris in the yard, fragments of furniture, frayed boards, sloughed shingles, and the like. Hillsmith gathered and put some of this under his arm, and walking tiptoed, went up to the house. Fauntleroy did the same. Still, he kept silent. Hillsmith carried the rubble to the veranda surrounding the old house and made a neat trail of wooden debris all the way around. Then he paused to listen at the walls. Was there, in the sultry silence of the ebbing day, was there any sound at all? If so, was it made by the wind in the huge old trees? Was there any other sound? A rustle? A click? Nasser Fauntleroy mocked his movements in silence. Why did he not leave? He was certainly in no way at ease. What is there which makes them both stop now? Perhaps Nasser Fauntleroy stops because Hillsmith stops. But why does Hillsmith stop? Why does he scan the moldering wall so carefully? Hillsmith picks up his can and runs. Hillsmith runs and runs, a teeter and a totter, around the veranda, and it is a marvel how thin a stream of fluid he has managed to spill, almost to spray, along the base of the walls as he runs and runs, tossing lit matches like fireflies. Then, with no warning, with no word, with no sound, Hillsmith seems to leave the floor,
to hurtle through the air, to burst through the rotting wall, to seize suddenly something in both his hands, something which rustles and rattles and clicks and kicks and struggles and slips out of Hill Smith's grip as Hill Smith staggers and half falls to the ground. Does Nasser Fauntleroy scream? If not, who then did? Once again, Vlad Smith heard his small daughter's shrill scream and felt her body arch in his arms. Did he smell smoke, or was that the stench of? Did he hear the crackle of flames, or was that the clicking sound of? My God, he whispered, and he felt his body grow cold. They poured out of cracks in the walls as if a roach's nest had been disturbed. They surrounded him with their horrid stenches and their horrible sounds. Then they clambered, roach-like, up the walls toward the ceiling. Now Vlad saw the smoke and the flames through the window, and he knew what had wakened them, and he knew they had to get out. But a paper man lay on the floor in the doorway, blocking their escape. It began to crawl towards them with its terrible claws extended, shredding scraps of rotting paper as it moved. Its stinking odor hit Vlad in waves. He watched for a moment and willed his stomach to be still. He recalled that the best way to kill a paper man is to break its neck. Vlad dashed forward and aimed a long, unused soccer kick at the creature's head. Something snapped lightly and rolled. It was the head, which stared with open eyes at him and writhed its lips at him and clicked its foul teeth at him. Then the headless body in the doorway, in its reeking and tattered clothes, the shattered body began to writhe and crawl. Its hands went scrambling, scrabbling and pawing and feeling for the missing head. Vlad knew it must not find the head. He broke the window with a single kick, seized the head by its scant and filthy hair, and threw it out into the flames. Still, the headless thing in the doorway twitched and flung its scrannel arms around and lunged. Then there was a sound like a breaking stick, and the thing in the doorway was still. Choking smoke filled the room as Vlad, shielding whimpering Bella in his arms, leaped over the paper man's body and raced out of the old house into the front yard. A large yard it is, and one in which many splendid carriages had come, one after the other, and then had ceased to come at all long years ago. Outside, it is by now the long summer twilight. Hill Smith walks along the old carriage drive, now a neglected lane, to the large oak tree draped with Spanish moss, very near where the street begins, and there he leans against the tree, facing the house. He waits. Hill Smith was still there long after the night air was filled with smoke and noise. Now there were many people with him, and police cars and fire engines and ambulances. Many people by then were there, shouting and screaming and pointing as the flames poured forth from every window of the old, old house. Purified by fire, Hill Smith cried. Again, he felt weak. He tottered. A man's large arm went around his waist, and Hill Smith found it immensely comforting. Purified by fire, he cried again, in a voice gone weak. Easy now, Mr. Hill Smith. Easy. Lean against me now.
That's right. You know me, Mr. Hillsmith? Dr. Eberhard? That's right. That's right. You set this fire, right? Why did you... His voice stopped abruptly. Every voice of the growling, howling multitude stopped abruptly. Atop the roof of the house, like a spectacle prepared to amuse some king of ghouls, appeared a row of figures dancing, stamping, pirouetting, flinging out gaunt arms and lifting gaunt legs. "Good Lord!" cried Eberhard. The crowd began its growl again, lifting gaunt legs and flinging gaunt arms in mad, discoordinate movement, stamping and dancing, and all silent, silently dancing, and all ablaze, dancing on the rooftop, all ablaze. And after a while, the roof fell in, and the crowd groaned. Steam and vapor from the fire hoses began to hide it all from sight. Hillsmith said, really gently, to Dr. Eberhard, "You see why? Purified by fire. No longer human. Abominations, they were." From a corner of the yard, the ambulance crew dragged someone kicking, dancing, flinging arms and legs about, someone crying and screaming, screams and cries, "Dry Bones live! Dry Bones live!" screamed Nasser Fauntleroy as they lifted him and carried him away. "Dry Bones live!" Hillsmith said so softly that Dr. Eberhard had to put his ear up close, "Purified by fire." Brad wrapped Bella in his jacket, and from the bottom of the jacket, a pair of very small feet projected.
"Bella, my God, Bella."
She opened her eyes and rolled them up until only the whites showed. Then she rolled them down. Then she looked at him directly with wide blue-gray eyes and shook her head and said, "No." Then she reached her arms to him and he couldn't say anything at all. "Was that a bad dream, Daddy?" she asked into his ear.
"Something like that."
"It was very bad. I don't like it here. Let's go home." To say that the office looked dirty and shabby was to say that water looked liquid and wet. Newspapers, documents, magazines, clippings, files and folders lay stacked and slipped and scattered. Someone was thrusting his hand into a large manila envelope. Someone was turning the pages of an old illustrated publication. Someone was going through a scrapbook, moistening loose corners with a small glue brush. On one webby wall was a sign, "The contract never expires." None of the men was working hard or working fast. None of them seemed interested in what he was doing. And whatever they were all doing, they gave the impression of having been doing it for a long, long time. One man ruffled through the clippings taken from the manila envelope, stopped, went back a few clippings, opened a drawer and removed an album, opened it, turned pages, put the album down and read the clipping, cleared his throat. Another man looked up, said after a moment, "What?" The first man said, "Makowitz head." The second stared. "Makowitz head?" "Yeah, The second man said, "Where's the rest of him?" The first man slightly shrugged.
"Doesn't say."
"McElwit. He went into the wall."
"Yeah, in the wall."
The first man fumbled till he found what seemed an old hand-penned list. From his rat's nest of a desk, he selected a worn-down pencil, the point of which he moistened in his mouth. Then he let his finger find a line. Slowly, as though he had all the time in the world, he made a pencil mark through it.
"Well," the man said, "he's out now."
"And he dwelleth in desolate cities and in houses which no man inhabiteth." Job 15:28.
The End by Goblin Hood. Of what amounts for a novella to a truly epic ghost story, and a really fitting climax to the distinguished career of Avram Davidson. Though I was never a big fan until this one story, I've always enjoyed his work. I think what I liked so much about this story was that it originated in a dream, according to his collaborator. And it strongly reminds me of a dream that I had shortly after I moved in to live here in Mansfield in Julia's apartment. I'd been here from, off and on for months before that. But it was during November of 2001 that I actually moved all my stuff here and changed residences. And it was shortly after that, early in December of 2001, that I had the dream. I won't go into details about the dream. It was like an anxiety dream about waiting for Julia to get home from work and being in a strange apartment and being worried that something had happened to her and so forth. Toward the end of the dream, she showed up, so she's back from work. And then suddenly, this new anxiety erupts. We're out in the hallway, and we see this ghost in the apartment. And this ghost, very tall, very thin and gaunt, kind of yellowish looking. He had a sort of a paper look to him. He had a big head. He looked a little bit like Frankenstein's monster, but not. He also looked more like Jack Pumpkinhead or something, It was very stick-like. He emerges, I guess, from the bathroom. Or just from thin air out in the hallway. We're standing in the hallway talking, and this ghost emerges from somewhere, quickly runs through the hallway and into this non-existent bathroom that is just, it's in the wall just in the hallway wall just before you get to the door of my room. In the dream, there was this extra bathroom that doesn't really exist. The ghost ran in there. There was a toilet with a toilet tank in the far corner by a window, which also doesn't exist. None of this stuff even corresponds to the way the house is laid out. But there was a, toilet in the far corner, and the ghost ran to that, climbed up on top of it, and began to disappear in the corner of the ceiling above that. And he said something to us. I don't remember what it was. I wrote all this down, but what he said was very enigmatic. Didn't really seem to have anything to do with anything. One interesting thing is that Julia has actually seen ghosts at various places. And they seem to be like that, like images walking through the room or something. But she's never seen one around here. I don't have any real reason to think that this place is haunted, but I have had dreams about it. So that's kind of why I wanted the ghost in, or the boss in the wall, because it reminded me of my own ghost dream. At least it was a fairly benevolent ghost. I wouldn't have wanted to get in his way, but he wasn't really doing much either, except getting out of our way. Meanwhile, this is probably the last set of tapes that I'm going to be making, or at least until some story comes along that I want to tape really badly. Because at this point, the equipment that I usually listen to stuff on has been eating tapes, has finally started eating my tapes, and so I don't use it very often. By now, I won't listen to anything unless I've got two separate duplicates made of it so that I can afford for one of them to get eaten. So as a result, I've got about 7 tapes now that I listen to a lot, because they're doubly redundant like that. This won't be one of them. I won't be making dupes of this. What I might do is, the machine I'm recording it on is relatively unused, and seems to be in good working order. When I want to listen to something that I worry about it getting eaten, I'll probably listen to it on this little tape recorder here. So that underlines why I'm not going to be doing much more of this. It just reaches a point of diminishing returns. If I'm not even going to listen to the stuff I tape, what's the point of taping it? I wanted this because this was an exceptional story. And I wanted access to a copy of it, and the only place I've seen it is in that one volume of the Year's Best Horror. And evidently it was only published in a limited edition chapbook or something, so I wanted to get a copy of it now while I had the chance, because that particular volume of the Year's Best Horror has been out of circulation at the library for months. I just happened to stumble back on it and was really glad. And so far now, I've had it out for 3 months. I've decided to finally go ahead, make a copy of it, whether I ever listen to it or not, and then go on with other things. I'm trying to do some painting now. In regards to that, my 3D paintings are going pretty well. I'm working much larger and with basically just blue and red and a little bit of intermediary colors. Interestingly, I recently got a hold of a couple of pairs of glasses that reverse that. They put the blue in front and the red in back. I didn't know that was even possible, but I'm probably going to experiment with those at some point. Since I've got a little tape to fill up here and I don't have much of anything else to say, I'll go ahead and make this like a kind of a postscript to my 3D tape that I made that I've never even listened to yet. In February of this year, I finally learned to see the magic eye images. So it took me 8 years to learn to do that. Then early this month, we made another trip up to Frankenmuth. It'll probably be our last trip for a while because the car really isn't in good enough shape to keep going up there. I got another kind of
cheesecake type hologram. This one, like a woman in sort of a thong, standing in front of a mirror putting on makeup. I kind of like it. Apart from the erotic aspects of it, I like it because it shows a mirror image within the holograms. Shows what that would be like. Then I got another really nice hologram of just a woman in a long flowing gown dancing, like kicking her leg high into the air. And that one can be seen from across the room, just like the image of Orion on my night sky box. I also picked up a couple of smaller holograms of, one of which is just a cheesy little robot space scene, which I really like. And the other one is left over from last year. I wanted to get it then and was hoping they'd still have it. It's like a stylized little cityscape with a central tower that's sort of like the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco. And from the top of this tower, there's a beam of light shooting out. This thing really does a good job of exemplifying what it's like when something seems to protrude out of a hologram. Because it really looks as if the beam is coming out of there about 3 inches worth. So I'm really glad to have that. And maybe best of all, I got this little pewter sculpture that was obviously an expensive gaming piece from some point back when holograms were popular. And this is just like an image of kind of a feminine or androgynous face. It's done directly into the glass. It like kind of like a circle of glass held above the scene, which is, like I said, a little pewter sculpture of some elf or somebody kneeling over a fallen warrior. The name of the thing on the bottom of the piece is called Eva Lynn or something, the life giver, so, or life bringer. Let me see what this is called. Yeah. Oh, Ava Lynn, the life giver. It's copyright 1993, I guess. So, yeah, it was from the hologram heyday. I mean, recently I like this because it's very easy to light. It looks like it's always there. I got it next to me on the desk, on the table. Recently I collected a bunch of comic book covers from the same period. Oh, say between 1993 and 1995, when they used to put holograms on comics a lot. Two of these are really special, one of them in particular. They're called holodiscs. They're both of Spider-Man, but one of them has him kneeling. When you lay it flat under a light and turn it around as if it's like a disc spinning on a turntable, he seems to turn around 360 degrees. He raises his arm and lowers it, but it's unique of all the holograms I've ever seen because it shows the entire figure. It's like there's, you know, the background is the thing he's on. So, I mean, this gives you an idea of just how protrusive this hologram is, because you're looking down at it. He seems to be a couple of inches high at his, you know, maximum arm stretching length. But he kneels, he raises up, he raises his arm, then he lowers it and kneels again. But as he does this, you turn the thing around and you see him from 360 degrees. It's like I've never even seen that in the kind of circular or semicircular tank holograms that are lit from within.
So this thing is kind of unique. The other one does something similar, but it's not as perfect, because in this case it's like the guy's standing and he's like Spider-Man's secret identity, the photographer Peter Parker. As you turn it around, that image changes into Spider-Man standing there. And even though you get a sense of the front and back of both of them, it's not like a perfect little, you know, complete image the way the other one is. Anyway, I've never seen anything like either of these. They didn't have anything like it at Riva's place up in Michigan. I know that. One thing they did have was a collection of black light chroma depth wall hangings, and I got one of them. It's like a space scene. It's not too bad. The glasses they give you with it are really weak, but it works pretty well with some of my other glasses, although frankly it doesn't even work as well as my work, and even my stuff doesn't work as well as this piece of fabric I got at Kmart that just happens to have planets on it that are in various bright colors, and this thing is more chroma depth than anything I've seen, just by chance. What else? Oh, you know, I collected some DC comics from 1998. They evidently did four comics in 3D. And it's a really spectacular 3D because it's in full color, which I've never seen in a comic book, or at least not often. But even so, it has the tendency, with the red and green glasses, since it's anaglyphic, has a tendency to flatten out into the usual monochrome kind of image. Meanwhile, Julia got me 15 holograms recently at a flea market sale. They're all like old trading cards. Some of them are really spectacular. Two of them are complete sets. There's two complete sets. One is like four Star Trek pictures that form together into one image. Another one is all five hologram cards of like Fievel Goes West. Then there's three cards by Bernie Wrightson that they're like horror images. They may have been a complete set. Plus a couple of others, including like a really fantastic image of the Joker. So I've got a lot of holograms. I recently got one from my friends David and Lori that shows sort of a moon landing scene with little aliens hopping around. Trying to cover everything. I found some good lenticular mouse pads recently. One is a planetary scene, another is something involving a drop of water. I also got another lenticular dreamscape image from Riva's companion piece to the one that I already had with the dolphin. I got a lenticular puzzle recently, put it together. It's a picture of a monitor or some other lizard. And I also got another puzzle that's really special. It's like a 3D image of some fish, but it's made up of sheets of plastic that are spaced about a quarter of an inch apart. I didn't bother with it as a puzzle. I just followed the instructions and put it together as a sort of a display item. It reminds me of what I was trying to achieve with my old paintings, like arenas, with layers of glaze between things and modeling paste, building stuff up. It's also similar to the way they did backgrounds in old animation movies like the original King Kong. They had backgrounds painted at different on glass that was separated at different levels so that it created a sense of depth even on the flat screen. Trying to get
anything in here that might still be relevant about the 3D stuff, because this, like I said, this is probably the last time I'm going to talk about it on tape. Learning to see those magic eye pictures really meant a lot to me, so I've collected several books of those, including one from Reva's place in Michigan. I've also been collecting books of stereograms where you use like a stereoscope to look at them, including this Civil War book I've got that's got like just page after page, some of which have been tinted, of stereo images from the Civil War. I mean, that is a real treat to have. And along the same lines, at a more recent flea market, Julia got me 12 reels of old Viewmaster reels. And some of these date back to 1951, the year I was born. A couple of them date before that to 1947, which I would have thought was predated the big 3D boom of the 50s. Some of them are religious scenes. Some of them are things like Yellowstone Park and Florida and some water skiers. They seem to work better in 3D for me than the more recent ones, which suggests that the technology may have degenerated since then rather than getting better, which you'd expect. I'd say that that would reflect how little people give a damn about 3D. Meanwhile, even the other Viewmaster stuff I've got, the more recent stuff, that doesn't work well for me because of my double vision, I can get it to work using chroma depth glasses for some reason, looking at the viewer through them, particularly through the weak pair that came with that wall hanging I mentioned. For some reason, the chroma depth glasses have a tendency to focus my eyes together, and the weak ones do that, but they don't distort the images as much as like stronger chroma depth glasses would do. So anyway, since I did the last tape, I think I mentioned getting that Kiss video at a store, the 3D chroma depth video. But back in September, I was lucky enough to, you know, out of the blue, I really needed something in 3D video by then, because I'd been slobbering for it, you know, hoping for different television shows to come through, and none of them did. Like, they never got around to rebroadcasting their 3D shark thing on the Discovery Channel. But instead, at Walmart, by the way, is where I got that piece of fabric. I think I said Kmart. Anyway, at Walmart, early in September, in the Walmart in Ashland, I saw for the first time a video of the Power Rangers that was in 3D. It was in the Pulfrix system. Since then, I've seen that one just about everywhere. I was hoping that that would lead to another infusion of these things, but it hasn't. It's not a bad video. It's, you know, pretty cheesy. It's got some interesting special effects. The 3D is nothing to write home about, but what do you expect? I mean, Pulfrix never was anyway. I'm just glad to have it. Then for my birthday, Julia got me not only a book of really good dinosaur holograms, but also a collection of science fiction music on CDs called Brain in a Box. And it's got this box that holds it
that has lenticular images on the side that make it look like there's an actual brain floating inside the box with a lot of complicated machinery. This thing is a really, really beautiful object. So, not sure what else there might be to say here. I probably already talked about my own lumograms that I made after the trip to Frankenmuth last year. But lately, there's been yet another kind of lumogram on the market, which is really interesting. I'm slowly trying to collect these, specifically attempting to get one or two specific ones. These are little plastic things that come in boxes, in packages of Doritos 3D chips. And all that means is that they're puffed, you know? I've been wondering what they were talking about for a long time, and finally, you know, because we collected these for the giveaway prize, I discovered that's all it means. They're puffed, you know, they're like three-dimensional instead of just flat chips. But the things they're giving away are associated with the latest Star Wars movie, and they're flat, they're little reverse sculptures. They're not entirely reversed, but generally speaking, they are. They're like lumograms in that, you know, certain areas are recessive that are supposed to come forward, and other areas come forward that are supposed to be shadow. And these things, you hold them up to a light and look through them. And where they look really stupid and crappy, if you just look at them as sculpture, if you hold them up to a light so that the light shines through them, they're like perfect 3D photographic images. So I'm probably going to collect a few more of those until I start getting the same ones, and then I'll quit. Anyway, this is about it. I have talked about my 3D collection here. It's like basically the only thing that interests me other than my own work and other than my life here with Julia and the animals. I don't know if Reva was even around when I made the earlier tape, but she's certainly around now. Right now she's in her kennel waiting for me to get done with my work here, so I'll take her for a walk. So I'm probably going to do that pretty soon as this tape runs out. I can't let her out until I'm done with the tape, because she'll come bounding in here and want to be chewing on the tape recorder and everything. She's like that. Reva's a little dog that we got up last summer. Julia had started feeling sorry for her at the hospital because Reva had been hit by a car and her jaw broken and her back leg broken. She's fine now. She's about the size of a Cocker Spaniel, and